Canada today represented by Simon Whitfield. He wears number 18.
It's a challenging course. It really showcases the best athletes in triathlon. The swim's rough swim. No hold back in the swim. There's no you have no weaknesses. The bike's a hard technical course. And the run's not just a flat track run. It's got some hills, and it's going to challenge people mentally.
Going into the Sydney Olympics, nobody's expecting Simon Whitfield. He's the only man racing for Canada. And he says, don't worry, I'm ready. He came out of the water. He was down in about 30th place, and almost everyone would have written him off at that point. But he was tenacious on the bike, got himself back into a position to have a chance. And then literally with a lap to go, I'm going, my God, I know how this kid runs. After 5K, he's in fourth place. And I'm like, oh my God, he's just run his best 5K of his life. He's got to do it again. And then it's third place. And then it's second place. And you can see Stefan Vukovic just up the street. And suddenly Vukovic, with 250 meters to go, starts looking back. And Simon, with that incredible sprint, blew by him. Vukovic didn't even try. No attempt to go with him. He just started to celebrate his silver medal. And when Simon Whitfield hit the blue carpet, I don't think he could have imagined what happened. He dreamed so many times about winning the race, he never dreamed about what would happen the second he crossed the line.
Crossed the line.
Crossed the line.
Crossed the line.
Crossed the line. Crossed the line. Crossed the line.
Welcome to The Greg Bennett Show, presented by Any Question. I'm your host, Greg Bennett. And today, well, I had an absolutely delightful conversation with one of my longest time friends and really good mate, Simon Whitfield. Simon won the Olympic Games in 2000, the very first triathlon Olympic Games. He got a silver medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games. And add to that his wins at Minneapolis and Hy-Vee, the biggest money races, his Commonwealth Games gold medal. And he truly is one of the greatest Olympic distance triathletes I think the planet's ever seen. More than that, he's just a really fantastic guy. He thinks deeply on things, and in this conversation, we really do go on a few tangents, but it was actually a lot of fun, and I think you'll get a lot out of this one. Even when we talk about just how the athletes of triathlon have changed over time and where they're at and where they're likely to go, and even we discuss, you know, who's the greatest athlete of all time and why, and I think his answer will surprise you. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. I thoroughly enjoyed it. A little bit of housekeeping before go on. I just want to thank you so much for listening and sharing the show. It continues to grow. I'm amazed that it continues to go, that I continue to be able to have such wonderful conversations with just incredible people doing remarkable things. And I feel truly blessed. So I appreciate you for listening, because you allow me to then go out and reach these people and have these wonderful conversations. Also, if you want to go check out Any Question, you can download it on iOS or Android. It's free for the first hour. You can go on there, ask questions, listen to all the amazing answers from just some of the world's greatest experts that are prepared to answer your questions and drop all of their knowledge there. So go check it out. That's Any Question, and you can check that out on iOS or Android. I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. And remember, success comes to those who endure just one moment longer. All right, today I'm joined once again by one of my closest longtime friends. He was last on the show January 5th, 2020. And this was an amazing episode. And it was actually one of the three that launched the show. His athletic resume it ticks all the boxes. Olympic and Commonwealth golds and biggest prize money victories, and just a consistency that had him near the top of the sport for, well over a decade. He's evolved from a young kid with an enormous passion and a little bit of running talent and, how would I put it, average swimming and biking ability to just eventually have weapons across the board. And I just loved watching him mature over sort of his 20, 25 year career into just an absolutely outstanding athlete. He's an icon in the world of triathlon. He's a household name in Canada. In fact, was the flag bearer for the Canadian Olympic team in 2012, which I believe, it was his fourth Olympic team. Anyway, more than any of that, he's just been a good mate of mine for, nearly almost 30 years, I think. So anyway, I'm delighted and honored to have him back on the show. So welcome, Thank you for joining me on the Greg Bennett Show, Simon Whitfield. How you doing, mate?
Benno, so good to be back. And thanks for the lovely intro. And the key part in that is this long-term friendship we built over and through sport that's just endured and endured. And same with Laura. And just, yeah, it's a thrill to be back here. And to think when we did that first show in 2020 of January, what was ahead of us in the next 2 years, we had no idea. And yet on we went. So yeah, it's great to be back. And thanks for having me. And it's always just great to chat.
I know. On those two things, you know, 30 years. I almost couldn't believe I was actually writing that down, like 30 years. And I think it was it Port Stephens or Port Macquarie?
Where were we? Port Macquarie. Yeah,
Port Macquarie. Mac, yeah. And you could probably tell me the exact year, but.
I would have to, what is it?
Is it 92 or 93? Yeah.
Yeah, 93. 1993. No, it's 92. You're right.
Yeah.
Roll, bro.
I almost didn't want to put that in the introduction because I'm really giving away our age by then. And I thought I was old at the time when we met.
I love it. I like that. I always love this idea. I have this notion that, like, at that event, someone walked by us and said, "You two will be friends for life. And one day you'll be on a podcast. 30 years from now, you'll be on a podcast for one in Florida, one in Victoria, Vancouver Island, and talking about life and your kids and all that." And we go, "Yeah, sure.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah, whatever. I don't even this guy. He's annoying the shit out of me.
This young guy. Why is he asking me all these questions?" But I just love those little whispers. I've thought many times in my life when I'm with someone years later, I thought, imagine someone years ago just said, "Hey, one day this will transpire," and you'd smile, right? Like if we knew back then that we were starting a journey of a lifetime friendship, we would have thanked that, said, "Oh, thanks, mate. Like, yeah, I appreciate you saying that. Like, we'll see where this goes." But yeah, to be here and doing that and to be able to talk about it all, super fun.
Well, we've been through a fair bit together, obviously in sport, but even the outside of sport, you know, you were a groomsman in my wedding in 2004. You know, you obviously know Laura really well as well. And so I think we've often expressed that, you know, you always felt like my younger brother to some degree.
Yeah,
and
totally.
And I think that bond has sort of been there for a long, long time. You also mentioned, so when I launched this show, January 5th of 2020, I actually had stockpiled 12 episodes before launching. And I remember I texted yourself and Craig Alexander, Mark Allen, Jan Frodeno, and I got like a group of you together and I said, "Look, if I start a podcast, you know, would you come on it?" And I remember you texted right back and said, "Yep, I'll be on it." And I was like, awesome. And I think out of that 12, I think I did yourself, you were either number one or number two. And you might have been number one, actually, the very, very first one I recorded, because I wanted to start with somebody that would give me a bit of breath, you know, a bit of room to screw up.
You go. And, got your back, bro.
Yeah, and it was great. You know, I launched on that day with that very first day with Craig Alexander, yourself, and Cam Worth. Cam was the only guy that I still haven't physically met. We know each other, but he was the only guy that I hadn't known. And obviously yourself and Craig Alexander and myself, we all have a past with Balmoral Triathlon Club and growing up in Sydney there. So it was fun to launch the show with two good mates that I've shared quite a long journey with. But mate, where are you in the world at the moment?
I'm on Vancouver Island. I'm at home. Life's good. Yeah. I'm into... You know, I just like spending time outside. I've got less devices than ever. So I kind of just get outside and go for strolls or get outside and go for a paddle, play soccer. All is well in the world.
That's
awesome. You know, as good as can be expected.
Are you still paddleboarding as much as you were doing? I know you were going between islands and everything up there.
Yeah, the same. I'm just up for, I love traversing. So like, as in like, I like looking at charts and maps and saying, I wonder if I can get from here to over there and back, or from here to there and someone come pick me up. And I like it either, you know, it could be as simple as just walking out the door and getting somewhere, or getting all the pack together and doing all of the preparation, whether it be paddleboarding or hiking or mountain biking. I don't, You know, I just like, I like organizing the gear. I like thinking about contingency plans. I love going out when it's, I don't have any idea where things are. Like I love putting myself in the place of like, oh, at some point somebody came here and they had no idea really what was coming up. And if I can find those experiences, and I've been able to, through some of the guiding I've done and some of the tours I've done, where I've been able to be in places where we're walking or in a place where I don't have any idea what's coming up other than the fact that it's like, you know, a general idea of the topography. And I really enjoy that. I enjoy getting a little lost. Just because it's such a privilege to do.
You know? I think that's fantastic. It's like you have an explorer kind of mindset where you just want to get out of the known and just be like, what's over the edge? I mean, is there any reference there we can conclude, like when we think about, as an athlete, we're always kind of peering over the edge of our ability. And, you know, now you've kind of taken that mindset and gone, well, I don't know what's out there in the dark space. I want to just go peer over the edge.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I used to think that I did sport for all these competitive reasons. And then I realized that so much of it really was just an excuse to go out and explore and to think of like all the places, whether we're in Font-Romeu going exploring the Backside Glacier, or when we were up in the hinterland in Noosa, just, you know, I wonder where that goes. That was at the essence, or being in Sydney at Knox and running around at the Gulston Gorge and pretending, you know, just thinking like I'm in the middle of nowhere. You know, a sport tends to, it institutionalizes and it gets really structured, and then the devices come out and things get measured and then it gets competitive, and all that stuff's wonderful. Like I love all that stuff also, but I will say that I really have refound the joy in just go out wandering out the door with no timeline, no nothing. And part of it is just this relationship with sport and competition that I have, because it's not a, what am I trying to say? It's not a free lunch, you know, like I loved competition and I like competing, but there's also another side to it. That's, I don't, you know, sometimes I go kind of trying to douse the pilot light. Like I've had a couple of moments in over 40s Masters soccer where I'm like, oh, whoa, I got to put this thing out. Like I'm getting too into this. I got to just enjoy it for what it is. So that I'm always walking that line. I'm always trying to find my own balance in it. And I'm good with that. That's kind of, isn't it? It's just the journey of being a human being. It's like the human experience is figuring out, oh, you know, where do I fit into all this? And so, yeah, I like that part.
It makes me think of, you know, talking about the competitive mindset versus the creative mindset. And I think it was in a book I was just listening to recently, Zero to One by, I think it's Peter Thiel. And he was talking about, I think, you know, it's okay to have the competitive mindset at times, but basically, and I'm going to bastardize this, but basically, if you really lean on the creative mind, that's where real greatness and things can come from, you know, and it's almost like you dabble in the competitive mind at times, but it's not where you really want to stay forever. You kind of want to go and test yourself in the creative space, and which is far more personal. And it doesn't take two, it takes one, you know, to do that.
Right. Yeah, right. That's such an interesting aspect of that, isn't it? It's its own solo journey. That goes all the way back to, I remember trying to organize the boys to get together to play street hockey. And I probably got into endurance sport as much because I didn't have to organize with anybody. I didn't have to say, hey, come on out, stay out longer. Just like, let's play. I got to just go out and do it by myself. So for sure that now I love, like, again, I just love looking at a chart and going, I wonder if I can make it from there to there. And then I'd have to sleep there. And then I need this amount of gear. And then I get to play my own adventure with it and be creative and just see, you know, what I'm capable of. And with no like care of, you know, I've got my little SOS GPS button. So I just go, oh, okay, I need to come home.
But I might have overdone it.
Totally. I like reconnecting with that, the notion of just exploring, but also like, I think in triathletes were just the, you know, one version of the people you'd send to go get the medicine back in the day. Like you'd say like, oh no, like the village needs medicine. Someone needs to swim across that, like ride a horse across that valley, run up the top of that mountain and get the little twig and then bring it back here. You go do it. And I think that was like, you break it all the way down. That was kind of the role we might have played back.
That's in your DNA. That's in your DNA.
Totally. That's what I think. I think right now I'm just like wandering around pretending to go get the medicine. It's just medicine for myself right now. But you know, like if the community need me, I'd be like, yeah, wait a minute. I could do that.
Yeah.
There's a reason to feed me. So yeah.
And I love that you've got the potential SOS button there. And you're willing to take yourself probably as far. I can't even imagine you'd want to even press that button. You know, it'd be almost like, no, I am not going to press it ever. But it's there, but I can do more. Is that part of it?
Yeah, you definitely touched on something. The one little note to self I have to make is like that line between where my ego comes in and doesn't want to push the button and really should push the button. And I haven't got there yet. I haven't even got close to that yet. Maybe one or two incidents out paddling where I was like, I could see how this could go wrong quickly, but it hasn't actually gone wrong yet. And as respect to the SOS button, I mean, like what a privilege to live in a society where I can push a button and this little, like I hear the chopper blades come or whatever. But also like those people have things to do. So you don't need to rescue some idiot that's me running, you know, out in the ocean. In saying that, like, I just like the contingency plans down from like, okay, like I would check in at this time and all of this stuff. And I have that contingency in case I need to spend the night or an extra night, or I have that filter if I need to do this. I really enjoy all those things. It reminds me very much of back in the day, preparing for like getting to the transition zone with all your gear. Because now I play soccer and it's funny. I have an Aussie buddy, Pikey, and he's laughing at me the other day because I show up with like a grocery bag full of my stuff. And he's like, didn't you race at the highest level? Like, is that what you look like when you race? I'm like, oh no. Like we have the whole pack and all the gear and all the mumbo jumbo. And he's like, oh, so it's reduced to a garbage bag now, or like a shopping bag. I'm like, yeah, I guess it has. And you know, I really like that part of it too. But then when I'm doing my own thing, when I'm with the boys, I like just showing up with the shopping bag. But when I'm doing my own thing, I do like all the gear because it's just part of it. It's something to organize. It's like something to tinker with.
I know, you geek out. And it's one of the great things about the sport of triathlon is all the stuff, all the gear. I remember, I want to rewind your clock a little bit. I know we've done that in the previous episode, but for the listeners that haven't listened to that, I'll get you just to a quick recap. But personally, I look back at the 80s, the bikes that were coming out and the clipless pedals and the first aero bars and all the neon colors. And it was just like in the new wetsuits. Remember when I started the sport, it was like you used sailing wetsuits. They'd even had the knee pads on them and everything. We saw it change, but let's do that. Let's do a quick recap of your journey. And I know you've probably told this story a bit, but I think for young listeners or new listeners that maybe don't know your journey, let's take me through when you first found your passion for triathlon and what did that look like?
I was just summer. We would spend summers up at the lake, a friend's cottage on a lake, and they organized this local triathlon. So I was like 11 years old. We'd been there, going there for years.
What year was that? Sorry, just to interrupt. What year was that?
That's 1986.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah. So we're like, our summer is spent jumping off the diving board and playing King of the Raft. And then one day someone says, oh, you know, Rudy and Joan Hollywood, who we're staying with, have organized Kids of Steel triathlon event on the weekend. Do you guys want to do it? And we're like, you know, like in the midst of playing King of the Raft, we're like, sure, that sounds fun. And we're just active kids. We play soccer all summer. We play hockey all winter. And at some point in there, I'm running, but I'm really just want to play sport. And then the Hollywoods are organizing this event and it's got all this, like, you know, in triathlon, well, it's still to this day, but when it first came along, it was kind of extreme, you know, it was like, they're going to swim, they're going to bike, they're going to run. And so we went and it was just a festival of sport. It was lakeside, little tiny town, north of Kingston, Ontario. And I just loved it. Like I had permission to wear, I wore a Mickey Mouse hat and boxer shorts with cows on them. And I came like, I don't know, like 20 something in my junior division. And I just had that like, oh, that was fun. Like I got to play soccer beforehand in the in the transition zone with my friends. We went and did this triathlon thing. And as soon as it finished, we were just running around playing soccer again or whatever sport we loved. And so I just had this lovely introduction to the sport. It wasn't like, it wasn't this big event that was preceded by all this very specific training. It was just like, oh yeah, what are we doing on the weekend? That sounds fun. And then it was just part of the summer. But I do remember thinking, huh, like I can't wait till next year. That was super fun. Like that really spoke to me. And so in between age 11 and 15, summers became more and more about going to the local, to the Ontario Kids of Steel races and less about soccer tournaments, you know? And so that shift began to happen. And I just loved the sport. I started collecting the magazines. I started reading about it. I started dreaming of starting my own bike company. It was going to be called Lightspeed. And then I found out there was already a company called Lightspeed. So I was going to call it Quentin Geronimo. I mean, I remember all the back in the day stuff that I just loved the sport. There was so much to think about and do. It was so innovative. It was a little bit outside, you know, it was a little unheard of, which also had a little, it had some sort of, I don't know, just unknown to it. And then, yeah, then I moved off to Australia to go to boarding school, and I just had that opportunity. It was something that was really, you know, my dad's an Aussie. I went there thinking I was going for school, but also really wanted to pursue this sport as I'd started to make some junior teams. And then one day at a race up in Port Macquarie, I met this guy who did really well in the race, and he started just, he would answer all my questions and gave me a lift home, and it was you. And you picked me up at the pool at 5:15 the next morning or whatever that was. And off we went. And that's, that was my triathlon journey. And part of what happened for me was that in Canada, we're quite risk averse as generally, you know, I'm going to stereotype, but we're my experience with sport when I was young was from outside of my family just said, go and put your best foot forward and we got your back. But outside of that, it was very much like, well, you should keep your goals, you know, a little bit more, be a little more cautious with those, with your goals, and let's start like slow. And when I got to Australia, Aussies aren't risk averse. You know, they're just like, you know, want to learn how to swim, get in the deep end, mate. And Chuck Arden was the swim coach at Knox Grammar School. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, oh, I just came and I want to do triathlon. I want to go Olympics. And he said, terrific. Get in the pool, mate. And that like gave me permission to just dream big, like be like, oh, cool. Like you're not saying yes, but maybe you should consider this. You're just like, get in the pool. Let's do the work. Like show me what you got. And I was like, oh, I that really spoke to me. Cause I had a dad who was like that when I was a kid, was just like, you're limitless, like go for it. My mom is the same. So they just gave us, my sister and I, permission to just dream big. And you know, whatever that is, 6 years later, I'm on the podium at the Sydney Olympics and I'm thinking, thanks, Chuck, like, thanks for just pushing me in the pool. So, yeah, there's the journey.
I love that journey. And there's one thing I want to touch on there because it's becoming clearer and clearer to me when I have these conversations now that I'm sort of 120 or something episodes into the show is this tremendous privilege that we've had from a lot of the guests I've had, including myself on this and you obviously, that parents that said, we have a bed for you if all things fail, right? But go out to the world and say yes to every opportunity, go explore and see what you can do. And I've been thinking more and more about it, how that is just the greatest privilege to know that if you fail, there's a bed and a roof over your head. It's not to say like my parents would maybe pay rent and everything else, but
yeah, sure,
that to me was probably the greatest privilege I think any of us have had. And it sounds to me, you know, your parents, I know them, your dad, very Aussie in that sort of sense. You know, it was quite a gift, huh?
Yeah, that's so true. And what a privilege, that's the word, isn't it? It's like, that is privilege to know like, hey, at the end of the day, you got a bed and we'll like, we'll turn on the heat and we'll put out a bed and we'll put on some calories. You can go from there.
You can go do it again.
I think the other thing is that they gave a love of sport. And I saw it recently. My kids play sport. My older daughter plays soccer. And the younger team was the younger, she's on like a selects team. So the younger selects team was playing the year older selects team. And so they're not supposed to beat them, right? And we're at the home turf, and imagine the scene. Like, you got the older, the kids, the parents of the older kids are on kind of one side. We're all sort of sitting together, but there's a little bit of separation between the two teams, the supporters, the parents. The kids are just out having a blast. Like, they're just playing the game. But the younger kids go up a goal on the older kids, which isn't really supposed to be, right? Like, that's not supposed to happen. The older kids are supposed to beat the younger kids. So it plays on, and the older kids are outplaying the younger kids, but they're not scoring. And so you can feel it in the bench between these parents. It's just like a little bit of like, oh, wait a minute. Like, this isn't unfolding how it's supposed to. And the game goes on and on and on and on. And then you can feel it. Like, you can kind of feel this, like, you can feel the older parents going like, come on, come on. And you can feel the young, this parents and aren't really going like, oh, this is exciting. Finally, the older kids score. And I jump up and like, that was awesome. And I look, and people are looking at me like, what? Like, not to exaggerate. Like, they're not like, why are you doing that? But there was a little moment of like, huh? Like, why are you cheering for them? And someone said to me like, well, oh, what was that about? And I go, oh man, I just love sport. It's so beautiful that right at the end of the game, the older kids tied it. And thank goodness for it, because that's sport. I don't care who wins this game. This is amazing. I just want to see these kids and all of us love sport. And that was actually the most poetic thing that could happen here, because it all just was like, ah, oh, there we go. And I also recognized it myself. I was like, oh, I have a very healthy relationship at the end of the day with sport.
Yeah.
Because my folks said at the end of the day, they're like, you know, you just got to admire athleticism. It doesn't matter what colors they're wearing, who they are. It's just like, admire athleticism. And I really want to impart my kids to have that. And I want people around me to understand, like, I just love sport. I love the poetry of sport. I don't really care who wins.
I think that's fantastic. It's not relevant. It's so well said, and it's had me thinking about my own upbringing and the love of sport that I had with the whole family. And in fact, there was a question on Any Question where somebody said, you know, if you could go watch any sport at the highest level, any sport, dumb, you know, which one would you want to go do? And I'd just come home from doing running races on the beach with my two kids, and there's a bunch of other Aussies that live on the beach up here, and they've got three young kids as well, and I stagger them all, and we do these running races and we do long jumps and everything else. And I actually replied on the Any Question saying, actually, my favorite sport to watch is my kids doing little running races on the beach. Like, the joy I got from that. Don't get me wrong. I love, like you, I love things done really well. I love Tom Brady, Tiger Woods, whoever it is doing whatever they're doing when they're on their game is absolutely outstanding. But watching kids just run and jump, that was, I mean, when they're your own, obviously, there's a lot of bias there, but there's this love of movement and sport and the competition, all of those bits and pieces, they all add up. I think that's really cool. When did you find, you went to boarding school, you had this great swim coach, you skipped over 6 years there and went straight to standing on the top of the dais at the Sydney Olympics, but was it before you went to Australia or once you were at Australia, you were like, huh, I might have some ability in this?
Yeah, it was before I got there. There's a picture of me running a track race as a like 10 or 11 year old. And I do have that look, you know, like I recognize in top athletes where you're just like, there's a moment where you decide like between this is comfortable and I like it here to like, no, I just like, I'm going to go, I can do a little more than this. Mm. I've seen a picture of Alistair Brownlee where it's, it might be his profile shot.
It was the one where he's running up the mud hill, the cross country.
It's awesome. Yeah. I was like, I see you, bro. Like we're from the same quarter of the universe. I know that look.
Yeah.
So it was that. I don't know if I would have verbalized it. I don't know what it like, you know, it's all memory, but I had a hard time turning it off. I just spent time. I had a lovely week just last week with a buddy that I've known since I was 3 years old. He spent more time with me, if you think about it, than anyone else, like almost in the entire world, like outside of my family, if you really think about the intensity of time. And he was like, he saw little moments in me. He was like, oh man, I remember your competitiveness. You had a hard time turning it off, didn't you? And I was like, yeah, I did, didn't I? He's like, yeah, I remember days where we were like, Simon, it's time to go home now. I know you want to keep playing and I know you just want to see if we can score another goal or do another thing. But like, it's like the lights have gone out. We can't see the ball anymore. He's like, you were a little bit like, and I was like, oh yeah, it's a relationship. Honestly, Benno, when I saw Blumenfeld build that hurt body, you know, he's running along with Lee and Haydenwild and at the in Tokyo, and he builds that hurt box and then he like lights it on fire and then he jumps in and he's like, I dare you to get in here with me. Like, that's what I interpreted it. I was like, wow, those other guys are actually better runners. They're beautiful runners. They're like, but this guy can just knows how to build a hurt box, get in and be like, I dare you to get in here with me. I watched it. We all family, we're all cheering away. We're like, that was awesome. And then like a few hours later, I had a funny outburst. Like I had this real feeling like, oh, what's going on right now? And I was like, I had to get outside and get like it out because something in me recognized that like moment and missed it or like felt unfulfilled from having to watch it on TV. I don't know what it was, but it came out like hours later out of the blue. I'm just like, oh, I'm not feeling very well right now. And the next thing I know, I'm like out the door and like just go, oh my goodness, I got to get this thing out. So whatever that is, I don't speak to think to know, I know what that is, but there's something that around that competitive nature that like need to like to build hurt boxes and win.
Yeah, there's a desperation, or it's like a desperation, you know, there's a desire. There's one thing to dream. You know, it's nice when it's out there, but it's almost that expressiveness that you have in sport, like we said earlier, is more about the individual that you want to take yourself and be in a place that's uncomfortable, unique, never been there before, explorative, you know, where you just kind of, when you watch the Olympic Games, like you mentioned, Christian Blumenfeld, and you can see the anguish all over his body, not just in his face, but he is suffering like. And there is, you have this, when you think back, when you have had those moments, and it's almost the most alive you could ever be, because you're now, like I referenced earlier, you're peering over the edge. What would happen? What happens if I just step a little bit further and all of a sudden you're there? And I think there's almost an addictive quality to when you've done it, you're like, ooh, I like that.
Think of it as almost perpetual presence. Like you have a deep sense of being completely in that moment. I picture the three of them running along and like the conversations begin in the other's heads around like second is fine, or like I'm hurting a lot, or like, oh, that last training block didn't go so well, or whatever it is, whatever doubt creeps in. And when I say Blumenfeld built the hurt boxes, what he did was he stayed present. He didn't think about anything but like getting to that line before the other people did. And I think maybe what's the addiction is like that moment. Because I've had it out in the ocean where I realized where it's a little treacherous. And I was like, wow, there's like a thin leash between me and eternity right now. Like if you've fallen in the ocean in 30 knots, and it's moving, like, and your board gets away from you, it's over. Like there's no swimming after it, there's no someone coming and getting you in time. It's like it's 8-degree water if that board got away from you. And part of me was like, oh, this is awesome, like that little piece of like cable is between me and eternity, and yet I'm gonna like ride that wave, I'm gonna figure this out, I'm gonna get home. And so it's a dance, you know, it's not a free lunch. There's a whole bunch of stuff that comes with that. And it's including that day where there I am, like having almost like an adult tantrum, and, you know, cause I can't, like, I don't have any place to express it. It's a journey. It's no free lunch.
Well, I think even if we reference, and I know you probably don't want me to, but I'm going to reference your Olympic Games when, much the same actually as what we saw with Blumenfeld, is, you know, you actually had to bridge gaps and turn up and put yourself into a place of very uncomfortable and desperation to try and make something special happen, you know. And you've done that a few times throughout your career. Actually, some of your finishes I think are the greatest we've seen, there are always these epic battles all the way to the line, dive sprint finishes in Des Moines, Iowa for the Hy-Vee triathlon. And you kind of go, you know, there is something about you and the way you like to race. I think I'm somebody that likes to try and smash it as early as I can, get a nice gap, and they go, okay, that's nice. But as you, yours often came down to a bit of a, let's all hop on the hurt box together with one, you know, 3 to 5 minutes to go and let's see who can outlast. You think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I got a governor, though. I think after Beijing, I never really, it's like my mind somewhere in my psyche was like, eh, we're not doing that again. Like I spent some chips that I wasn't able to spend later because I never hurt the same. Hmm. I never tried the same. I never like got even Hy-Vee, which was a year later. The actual way the race unfolded is actually fairly painless all the way to that final sprint finish.
Yeah.
I never really went to the same hurt box.
Your bucket
was empty. The place I find it now, though, I find interesting is at the top of the box on a corner kick. I love to go stand right at the top of the box. And there's something in me that's like, I'll take, let's do it. Like I'll take on, I think I can get my head on the ball. And there's guys that are bigger and stronger and taller. And I'm like, game on. Let's go, bro. Like you try and that guy's going to kick that thing. And I'm going to jump up and put my head on it. And I'm smaller than you. And there's still, I like a bit of that. Like there's still that spot there. I'm still at the end of the day. I'm like, no, I'm going to show up. I'm going to stand on that line. And some guy may outjump me, may do it, but I'm going to have showed up to be on the top of the box to say like, you're going to have to overcome me to get this spot. So there's something in there that speaks to. And it comes, like I said, it comes with a whole bunch of other things that like, I've had my fair share of moments where I've been unable to control that. And there's like, you know, it's not a free lunch, but it is what it is.
I think it's when you feel alive. I think that's why mountain biking is so popular for, it seems every guy between the age of 35 and 55 is out there, you know, taking on something that scares them. You know, you're doing something and trying to overcome that element of fear. For me, personally, that's mountain biking's been, and we mountain biked when we were in Boulder together. And I love that ability to just do something that scares me and overcome it. It's a bit like you in the soccer going up for a header against a guy that's several, you know, 6 inches taller than you or whatever, and just seeing if you can make it happen and then doing it. Have you actually on that? Have you ever headed a goal from a corner kick?
Yeah. And here's the thing. So I have, and in my mind, it just looked like spectacular, right? It's just like in my mind, I was like, oh my God, that was Ronaldo. But we have this thing, Benno, we have this thing called the Vivo, I think it's called. It's like it's a soccer camera. So it tracks the ball. Yeah. So our over 40s games are all recorded. They're hilarious. And so we played in something recently called the Tweed Cup, which is our green team versus our white team. And it's like just people who live in our neighborhood. We call it the Tweed Cup. It's hilarious. It's just a bunch of people who love going to the pub together. And of course, because sport's amazing, at the end of the game, it's like 3-2. Last time we played, they beat us 3-2. This time they're up 3-2. And then finally, AJ, right at the end of the game, puts this cross across and I like head it in and we tie at 3-3 and we're all like, yay, that's amazing. I watched the thing later thinking that I like made this like leaping header. It literally looks like the ball just kind of hit me in the side of the face and then barely hit it in. Like in my mind, I legitimately thought I like guided it in with this perfect header. And when you watch the tape, it literally looks like it just hits me in the side of the face. And my little belly like goes like jiggle, jiggle, jiggle. So whatever, that will never make it to the light of day. But I like waddle back in my mind. I like sprinted down the sideline and I ran across and I diving headed it. And it's not what happened. That's not what happened. There's no.
I think the last time you were on, we shared these kind of stories where our minds kind of inflate how wonderful they were. I think you talked about the time you were in Beijing, sitting in the waiting room with Javier Gomez and Jan for dinner. And I think we even inflated the story of the Olympic story of you jumping off the dais and putting the medal around my neck and saying, you know, and all of that we talked about. And we, it's amazing how our minds can tend to make greater stories out of potentially what they really were. But still, I mean, you've just made me laugh. So it was definitely worth it.
I love that part now. I didn't realize that. I thought for so many years, I thought that memory was just this it was what I thought. If I remembered it that way, that's exactly what happened, because why else would it be any other way? And then there was this point in time where I was like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. These things are all shifting. And every time we tell the story, every time we even think about it, it makes one more degree of shift. And by the end, like, you're not watching it on television, you're like in the game. And I'm okay with that. Like, once you start to recognize that, you don't put so much onus and so much story attached to memory. That's like my journey in it. It's like, I don't need to live this narrative that it was this and that. And while it's fun to like relive these things with you because it's like our origin story, I'm also very careful to like walk out the door and remember I'm just some being, you know, just some animal that like to put heavy packs on and go for long walks. And like, I don't need all the other stuff is just narrative. Like, my name is so-and-so and I'm friends with so-and-so and this is what happened in my past. Like all that stuff. Sure. Great. Whatever. Great. Neat story. At the end of the day, it's the time is now. And like, you're just an animal that's trying to find water and, you know, and calories and heat and go back to bed. And
then your time will be up and then your time is up and it's like, oh, okay. I mean, I think when Laura and I first met and, you know, you and I were definitely both consumed by what we were doing, you know, if you think 2000, you know, the 6 months leading into the games, I think Laura came in and I remember thinking, well, you know, I don't think I was number one in the world, but I might have been number two or something. And you were right there. You know, we were doing all right. And I remember saying, Greg, nobody cares. I was like, ouch, that really hurts. But it was so true. And I used that for, you know, the last 22 years. And it's been like that mindset that of, look, you go out in the world, you explore, you have competition, you use others to try and better yourself and experience things, you know, just experience life as much as you can. And knowing that your time will be up and everybody's got their own agendas and they might care to your face, but, you know, you'll hang up from this call with me and you'll be like, okay, back to my day and that'll be it. And, and it's okay. Once you get your head around it, it's like, okay, it's we've all got our stuff and we're all just going to keep moving on.
What is it, Ash Bradley, the tennis player?
Bader. Ashley Baddies. Baddies,
yeah. So she's just retired, right? And she said...
25, yeah.
And she said, what did she say? I don't... My who I am is not just tennis and who I am is not my results. And I want... She said, I want to... de-link my results from my sense of self and my sense of worth. And I was like, oh, there you go.
Very
you
profound for 25. I know.
It's like, great, good job.
that was like, so far from my line of thinking as a 25-year-old.
Totally. Oh my goodness. I just started my infatuation with my story of self then.
My infatuation of myself.
It's true though, right? Like that's the glitch. It's like, you go up on stand on top of the podium and then all of a sudden, like everybody, it's adulation and then reinforcement of your story. And everyone's pretending at the time to want to know it. Like, tell us more about that. What was that like? Da, 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 da. And then you're like, wow, I'm really interesting. I got a big story to tell. I'm really interesting to everybody. And then when they're not interested anymore, you're like, well, I'm still interested in myself. Here's my own story. And then at some point you go like, huh, none of that matters. It doesn't, I got to go get water, I gotta go get food, and I gotta stay warm, and I should try and do that for the people around me also. And like, the rest of it is just a big long story. And obviously, you know, our mortgage is attached to that and all, like all the responsibilities of life that come with like having a story.
You can't shrug it off.
I get all that. Can't shrug it off. I get all that, but at the very end of the day, all that's just made up. It's just made up stuff because we're just bored apes wandering around trying to figure it out. And I'm okay with that.
I know. If you actually simplify everything we're doing, you're like, wow, it really doesn't matter and nobody actually cares. And that was one thing I learned out of this whole COVID experience was it was suddenly like the world lit up and go, we're going to die or we could get very sick. And I was like, what? I thought we all knew that. I remember talking to my mom several times and I often, and on this, I'm not making this up, often have this idea that today could be my last day. It hits me like a blade quite often. This could be my last day. And I don't mean to be morbid. It's actually like, okay, what do you want to do? And that might mean sit on the beach and do nothing. I'm not saying you have to be productive every day. I'm saying it's just knowing that your time could be up. And mm-hmm. for me, that the priorities suddenly change when you have that mindset going, well, I better tell my kids that I love them and my wife that I love them. I better call my mom and I better call my mate Simon Whitfield. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden you have this mindset where you want to connect with people. Starts to become the priority for me. And I'm kind of like, you have that. I have that all the time. I'm telling you, it's like maybe that's in my DNA, but I found that whole COVID thing, suddenly people got a slap in the face. Everybody woke up and went, oh, we could die. I'm like, yeah, yeah. Guess what? It's going to happen. Whether it's tomorrow or in a couple of years or, you know, you and I getting older, so it's definitely coming to countdown time. But it's like, I don't mean to be morbid. For me, it excites me. When my dad passed away a few years ago, it's not like he'd lived a great life. We had a celebration. It was a wonderful funeral. Miss him, of course. But you also take that with you and go, okay, you've got limited time. Create some urgency here. What do you want to do? And, you know, I love that. I was on somebody else's show a while ago and they're like, oh, no, I'm going to live forever. I was like, oh, God, how awful. I would get nothing done. I'd still be in bed. And there'd be no excitement left in life, you know. There'd be nothing left.
You could live forever. Like, oh, dear, no.
Oh, no. I feel tired just thinking about it.
Oh, dear.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to circle back on Ash because that was, she said she's retiring at 25. And so I did dive into it a little bit because I must admit my first reaction was like, what? You know, you're crazy. And a bit like you said, mortgages and all that kind of thing. But, you know, she's like, I always wanted to win Wimbledon. Did that, you know, always wanted to win the Australian Open, did that. It's kind of like, and she's got one more, right? I think maybe US Open or something. I'm like, she's got three Grand Slams and she's like, yeah, box ticked. Next. I'm like, okay, I get it.
That is the evolution now of athletes. Yeah. She's like, I actually think she's so athletic and so, just so good at whatever she does that she's probably somewhere said, huh, I could actually go do any sport or any activity that I want.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be just so good at it.
That's what my mom said.
And I get to explore it.
They think she's going to, she's done cricket already. I don't know if she played. Did she play for Australia for cricket? I don't know. She may have.
I don't know. She's athlete.
But they said maybe golf is her next. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's going to redefine where we've seen athletes like that over time. But I think we're going to see more and more athletes where they're just like, oh no, sorry. That person can just pick up anything and just go do it. It's awesome. So, and she's not so attached to the results of it all because, you know, sport has become such big business. But I will say, you know, thank goodness for it. Like, look what's happening in the world right now. I do start to say, hey, you know, maybe if we weren't so this nationalistic piece where we like pushed people away from sport. We said, no, there's no room for you here. You can't compete here because of this, this, and this reason. And all the reasons that seem legit, they all seem at the time like, yeah, that's a legitimate reason. You got to blame them. You got to make them. Now what's going on? Like we isolated society or like the world has isolated people. And now we have a war. Like we have another war, we have other wars going on, but we have another war. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, that kind of backfired. Like maybe sports should have been the place, the only place, not the only place, but the first place where everybody's invited. And I understand you've got to play by the rules. I understand all that bit. But at the end of the day, isolating people like that and isolating a nation and saying like, no, we're here, you're over there. Yeah, okay, great. But like, these are the consequences. The consequences are like, They now they're isolated. Now you're not talking anymore. And oh, oops! Now you have a proper war.
Yeah.
So like, thank goodness for sport, and also like keep sport accessible and keep sport as a common place of truce. Because otherwise, we'll go fight. We don't want that.
Quick mini break just to remind you to go check out Any Question. Again, you can download that on iOS or Android. Go ask questions, listen to answers. It's free for the first hour. Go check it out. I'm sure you're going to learn a lot. I had Rowdy Gaines actually on the podcast recently, and you know, he told me his story of you know, being number one swimmer in the world, world record holder and everything for in 1980 and not getting, you know, then 3 months before the game, he's been said, you know, you're not going. And he handled it very well because he was fortunate enough to go on and win gold medals in 84. But still, you see these kind of things happen and you're like, oh, stop using sport as a pawn. I get it, but I also don't like it. I don't want to get it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm like, oh, I think that was best of intentions, but
yeah,
like, what's the unintended consequences here? Because I'm really thinking, I've spent a lot of time recently thinking about like Brukhinkov and Vladimir Polopolensky and like the people we raced for years that were just, they were just another person in the cafeteria trying to get ready for the event, you know? And there was lots of, and at the end of the day, they're just, Vladimir Polopenko was quite affected by it because he's from the Ukraine. His experience was so different from mine growing up, you know, like he grew up in a tower with three families in one bedroom, like, and then got shipped off to race in some other place my experience was so different than that. And I always gained some perspective from him because I was like, huh, like you just came from such a different background, had so many different opportunities than I did. And that really helped inform how I saw sport in the world. And now with what's going on in the day to day, I really spend some time thinking about those athletes and not just one side of those athletes, but like all those athletes that at the end of the day are sitting there going like, terrified out of their mind, probably sitting somewhere going like, what is going on? And I'm thinking, oh man, like, let's get back to sport. Let's get back to people.
It's fascinating when you bring up something that I think we were both very fortunate to have, was that it was the breakfast conversations more than it was being on the playing field with a lot of the guys that we battled in racing, that you actually got to understand all these various cultures. You know, our mutual friend, Jan Rahula, who, you know, was bronze to you at the Sydney Olympics. And, you know, he invited me to Czech Republic for many years. I raced with his team in Czech and this was 95, 96. So just after the wall had come down, it was all very, you know, it was a cultural shock for me coming from, you know, Mossman, Sydney, you know, fairly privileged upbringing. And then a little bit of a slap in the face of going, wow, this is what general studies at school or geography at school were about. You know, like I was like, it had always been remote through study, but then experience, it's amazing how it opened your eyes. And I think when you think about those breakfast table conversations with whether they were German, East or West German, and, you know, we always got a good sense of the world through our peers that we later on race that day, but you would be able to sit and have a casual conversation with them in the morning.
Oh yeah. Leandro Macedo from Brazil, just hearing about what life in São Paulo is like. And you're just like, wow.
Oh my goodness.
Like the world is so diverse and different. And here we all are just meeting up in Ishigaki Jumi, Japan.
Ishigaki Jima.
At the Mirahara Hotel, you know, like, thank goodness for it.
So, gosh,
there you go.
That's awesome. So let's shift gear a little bit and just dive into the world of triathlon. You know, we've talked about the Tokyo Olympics and Blumenfeld, and how do you think the athletes have changed over, say, the last 35 years that we've both been in and around the sport? Do you think the athletes are much better? I don't want to compare generations so much, but just what are we seeing in terms of athletic ability at the top?
Yeah, we're just seeing the evolution of it all, aren't we? It continuously evolves, and they come into it from a young age. You know, they've been doing very specific, maybe they've been doing very specific training, or maybe they've just come in and they're just an athlete who's just like can pick up any sport. The science support and the understanding of it has really, I think, changed. As in, I think in my generation, a lot of the sports science support was there, but they were making a lot of errors, or there was a lot of things that were impractical. It was like, that's a great idea and all, but like, that's super cumbersome. Mm. Like that device barely works, or it doesn't work, or the battery dies all the time. And now they're able to quantify and measure. And then they're even evolving beyond that to be able to like do all those qualifications, like quantifications and da da da, but also keep that subjective art of like, at the end of the day, it's just a race. You got to figure it out, you know? So to see where the sport's going, to see, you know, obviously the Norwegians are the making a bit of a splash in triathlon. And then to see the old guard, you know, with Jan, so impressive to see what he's done, and Nicola Spierig to see what she's done, and Daniela Reif. But then to see this new generation come roaring through, I love it. I mean, Collins Cup was just, A, there were two experiences. There was A, was seeing you and Phil Liggett in the cafeteria. That was its own amazing experience. and meeting and spending some time with Lionel and Aaron Sanders, that was really lovely. That like whole piece was also part of it. But then to actually see them up front racing like that again, and to see the level of the sport and just the attention that they pay to every detail. You alluded to one of my favorites earlier. I've never met him either, Cameron Wirf.
Yeah.
Like this, just this athlete, you know, like I'm a rower. Then I'm a cyclist, then I'm a triathlete, I'm also a cyclist, and I'm also hysterical, and I got an opinion on things.
Yeah, and I'm into like finance and investing, and I understand. I'm like,
exactly. That guy's amazing, and he's hilarious, and yada yada yada. Like, it's just the personalities of our sport have really also come out.
Do you think that's a little bit sort of, we were talking off air about it, but you know, the YouTube generation were able to dive deeper into their lives a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be an interesting journey in itself. Like, I don't think I envy some of that.
No,
when we're doing it right now, you know, like this, in this like deep dive of thoughts on things, and like, it's lovely and I like that. But to do that, to have a show where you were doing that consistently like that on camera, where the camera follows you around. Like, I've watched a couple of them. I'm like, oh my God, are you in the cafeteria with the camera following you? Like, I've done a bit of that and I really felt uncomfortable with it. I was like, oh my goodness, I need to stop. Like, I don't want a camera following me.
It's amazing, isn't it? They do it all the time. I mean, Lionel Sanders, Lucy Charles Barclay, they're probably two that come to mind that, I mean, they're great. I have been inclined to tune in every now and then, but it's like, yeah, I don't want a camera showing my miserable days at work. I just want to or my great days. I don't even like my great days. I don't want to brag on my great days. I kind of just leave me to it, right?
They're so articulate. That's the thing that I'm finding. Like, people have lots of opinions about, I'm sure, but I really enjoy, like, say those two as an example, and Paula's show and all the different like venues. I get it. Sometimes people are like, oh, it's too much. Well, you have the choice. You know, don't watch
it. Try to watch it, yeah.
But I enjoy like Lionel's show, and just how insightful he is into the journey, how honest he is about it, how much he understands about his own, like how to fine tune this performance machine that is Lionel Sanders. Talbert, the videographer, just the way he tells stories and his whole personality coming mixed in there. It's fantastic. They're doing a fantastic job.
Oh, they're doing a brilliant job.
Like, tip of the hat to him. And it's going to be great material for future generations to learn and knowledge share from. So in saying all that, like, wow. And then also to be able to actually show up on a start line, having talked about
and
it
and perform. So much, I know.
Perform, I'm just like blown away. I'd
fall to pieces. Wow. Well, you know me, I always talk myself down just so I would take the pressure off myself. But I was one of those people that was like, Lionel, oh yeah, whatever. And then I've tuned into his YouTubes, and like the vulnerability and the authenticity is just
great.
Unbelievable. And it's amazing how some of the greats, you know, I'm going to refer back to Any Question again here, because, you know, the swimming channel has just absolutely exploded. And Caleb Dressel's on there, and you could not get a more authentic and vulnerable human being who's potentially the greatest swimmer we've ever seen on the planet. You know, yes, Michael Phelps is there, but this guy's, I tell you, what he's doing is insane. And he's just this guy that you want to reach out and give a hug to. And just like, he is, I feel like I'm a friend with him, but I'm connecting through Any Question in the app. And it's like, that's how good they are at connecting with you through these devices that, I am incredibly like you. I'm impressed by their ability to share like that. And, 'cause I certainly couldn't.
the hard part I had with it for myself was manufactured spontaneity. I suddenly realized, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm also starting to orchestrate things. Yeah. My mind is like able to see ahead a little bit and go, I'm a pattern recognizer like anybody else. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I get applause for this. I don't get applause for that. So I should do more of this. Mm-hmm. And that, and like all the way through, I think one of the, I don't know, change points for me, or like an inflection point for me, was really starting to understand dopamine a bit more. Mm-hmm. And it was, I listened to a podcast and about dopamine. I was like, I literally felt it. Like, I was like, oh, thank God. I just listened to that. Like, I understand it. I understood a bit better. It's like when you go carry a flag into a stadium and everybody cheers and tells you like, you're the flag bearer. You're the, you know, da, 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 da. Your brain the next day goes like, hey, it's cool and all, but like, when do we get to carry the flag in the stadium today?
I need that hit again.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Your brain is like, nobody it's amazing, explained that. It's amazing. Nobody said, like, people alluded to it, but I really needed a sports scientist or someone to stop and go, hey, here's what's going to happen. Your brain just experienced 1,000 dopamine, whatever you want to call it, units, whatever it is. And now like the rest of your day is like a 7. Yeah. And so we got to migrate, like we got to mitigate that gap. You got to understand it. We got to build some strategies around easing you back down. Instead of just saying, here's a flag, carry it. Like, we're not going to talk to you tomorrow. That really affected me. So I had a 10-year journey of like trying to understand what was going on, where logically I was doing things, but something inside of me was also like, hey, when's the flag thing again? When do we get all that applause? When do we get all that dopamine? Yeah. I want to anticipate. I'm anticipating all of that again. That journey I found, and whatever, you know, like what a privilege to be going through that kind of journey. But that really helped.
No. But it's one of my favorite things to be studying as well recently. And I it was a book I listened to by Simon Sinek. You know, Simon, he's the why, what, how guy or whatever. And his book, Leaders Eat Last, I was eating. And it was all about all these hormones. And he basically talking about these, what do you call them? Selfish hormones or whatever, dopamine and endorphins, right? They're kind of like, you know, they're all about you. And they're about mm-hmm. you because it's that fight or flight response mechanism brought into the body that, you know, go, 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 that kind of thing. And me, me, me. And then you have the serotonin and the oxytocin, which are all about the love and the sharing and the community. And it made me kind of go, ah, you know, there's a deep, when you're talking serotonin and oxytocin, that they have a stronger meaning about others and the bigger picture, whereas dopamine mm-hmm. and endorphin are about the now and about the me. And it's like, I get it now. You know? And I want more of that. Oops. And I love it.
Oops.
Oops. Did I say that out loud? But I mean, that's what, you know, that's what we have with the social media generation. It's like, I need these little splashes of, oh, feel good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, now I feel, and you know, I'm certainly not perfect by any means with any of that, but it's nice to at least understand what's going on with the chemistry, you know?
Yeah, that helped me a lot, was understanding or starting to understand.
Yeah, starting to understand. I agree.
Yeah, having a glimpse of understanding about what, like, oh, that's what's going on there.
Yeah.
And then not having like angst about it, to be like, oh, that's normal. Like, of course we're like that because our first instinct is survival. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's the very first thing we're trying to do. So obviously gaining some attention and finding out ways that other people will help, like, we can feed ourselves and feed others is like at the end of the day, our like core tenant or whatever, our core being. So understanding a little glimpse of that or getting some idea of how that all worked, I was like, oh, that helps me. And now I'm really like, I try and structure my day so that I'm like, okay, I'm going to get up in the morning, I'm gonna get outside and get some sunlight. I'm going to have a large glass of water before I do it. I'm going to take in all of that, like the energy that I can, because my day is going to unfold in the manner that it's going to unfold. And I may as well set it up the best I can.
Do the best you can to start the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I can do.
We were talking about that before I hit the record button about just doing some really simplistic things. You know, they're pretty low down the totem pole when you think about it, to just step outside, look at the sun and drink a glass of water. You know, it's like, it's not a menu. We're not saying you're going out for a 10K run in 30 minutes. It's actually have a glass of water and look at the sun and get your body clock right. And it's like, I guess I could do that.
I like, too, that idea of, like, you're calibrating your visual and auditory systems. So you're calibrating the distance between things, both visually and auditorily. So your proprioception is more fine-tuned throughout the day. Like, you're just like, of course that makes sense. Mm. And if you wake up and you wake up in a small room where the walls are only 4 feet away, and then you go straight to your computer and the thing is either, you know, it's like 2 feet away, and you spend your entire day locked in that little box, then there are consequences to it, you know? Like over time, the accumulative effect of that is that your world becomes very, very small, and then your visual and auditory spatial relations become very condensed. And so going outside and seeing the horizon and realizing like, oh, that tree is like closer than that other tree and it's far away and I can hear that bird from over there are really important things, especially in this age of screens where your whole day, I mean, how many days, if you thought of 10 years ago, you're going to spend, you could spend your entire day
all day,
in front of your
all
screen.
Day in front of a screen.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's just insane.
It's an interesting topic you bring up because I had Dr. Tommy Wood on and we were talking about this and I was sort of saying, you know, 150 years ago and throughout history, it's been, the stresses in life have been massive. You know, massive. Shelter, food, water have been very real. You don't know if you're going to get them. But once you've got them, you're completely grounded. Whereas mm-hmm. for us now, we have all of the big, big things for the most part. Most of us do in the Western world anyway. But we have mental health is absolutely, you know, it's terrible. It's all around us. And it's kind of going, what's going on here? And it's like, we're never turning off. We're actually mm-hmm. never turning off. And if we do, it's for split moments. And then we're on. And you get up in the morning, you look at your screen, a small screen. Then you hop, you know, a bit later, you hop on a slightly bigger screen. And to unwind, you turn on a bigger screen. And then you might even look at your little screen one more time before you try and go back to bed. And it's kind of, you think about the brain is totally lit up all day, every day. You know, how do we escape that in a world that's become how we communicate? It's how we do our work. It's how we relax. It's all around us. And like you said, we're a bit the same, you know, try and have that morning routine where at least we're doing things to ground ourselves a little bit. And for me, I have an afternoon routine where it's every afternoon without fail. I've made it very clear in the work that I do that don't call me after five. Phone won't be on. I have dinner with the family and we go to the beach every single day. And that's important for my health. But it's, you know, this screen world that we live in and this just being on and available, I think is creating a lot of unnecessary accumulative stress. You know what I mean?
I tell you what though, to me, it seems like as an athlete, I'm like, wow, that would be such an advantage. If you could get yourself off those screens, if you could figure out how to tap, you know, like cut the cord, I think the advantage you would have would be quite something. Like, because everybody else, you know, everybody else is in that world of checking their phone in the morning, checking it throughout the day of some sort. So to me, I'm like, wow, wait a minute. If Gustav Iden is like filming every moment and sleeping beside his phone, and I'm not to pick on Gustav because he's incredible. But,
Sorry, Gustav,
because honestly, the dude's incredible. He's awesome and his show's great and blah, blah, blah. But I do sit there and go, huh. You got to play, either you're going to beat him at the same game. You're going to do the same thing. You're going to have your own show. You're going to do your lactate testing. You do all those things and you can do it better than him, which is, you know, plausible. Sure. Or is like, there's such a significant advantage over that by cutting the cord and saying like, no, I have a dumb phone. Like I have a flip phone. I'm not available. I'm a monk and I train. Mm-hmm. I have social, I have all those things because those are important, but I don't need to get them through a screen. I'm just curious, like, is that the like Achilles heel for that top echelon? Is if they're all totally engrossed in their screens, is the foil to that to show up as the person who's not? And I don't mean like it's hiding from it. I mean, it's just legitimately like, I don't need any of that. I'm just.
Simon, this is, it's whether that's right or wrong, the fact that you think about it like that is what I love, right? It's like to stop and think and go, you know, there's that competitive mindset kicking in, going, well, how do I do something? How do I beat these guys? I just love that. And it's how you operated, you know, and for me, that was more of a bull at a gate type personality. You know, you were always considering how to look at things slightly differently and how to approach it differently. So I just think that's great. I just want to mention that.
There you go.
It's really cool. It's the one takeaway we can take from this. I just think it's outstanding how you look at it. I'm going to shift gear a little bit just for a bit of fun and, you know, go pretty light here. And it's a conversation that I just think is really fun. It was on, actually, again, to reference any question, I apologize, but there are fantastic questions coming on there. And one of them is just simply, you know, who's the greatest athlete of all time in history and why? And so this is a complete, like, we're shifting gear over here. And I'm curious to your world, because you actually know a lot of them. You've been around, you've seen a lot. You're a lover of sport, like you said. I gave my answer on any question, which I think I outlined about 30 athletes.
Wow.
Men and women from all the way from the Great Depression and Don Bradman in cricket all the way through to sort of the more recent, you know, athletes of today. But what about you? If I'm putting you on the spot here, are there any that jump out to you?
Kai Lenny, the waterman. There's something so basic and pure about, I know there's all the gear that comes with it, but at the end of the day, like we came from the ocean, and there's this athlete who can paddle surf, kite surf, foil surf, the biggest waves ever. Like he can do the whole gambit. And if you spend a bit of time, I just saw a clip of him. He's on the America's Cup foil racing boat and he's fine. And then he's out massive wave surfing at Nazara, biggest wave there is. And he's kite surfing this thing. And I just think like what an athlete.
Yeah.
Just like the purest form of like to be a waterman, to do something where you got to hold your breath like that. Like that's a whole other ballgame. Meet sports, like love all your different sports. We made up all these wonderful, cool sports. You got, and then that one over there, you can't breathe. Like you got to do this thing where you got to tackle this thing that could literally kill you. Like this massive wave is tumbling down in your head. It's very different than like, I get it. That guy in the crease is huge and he's going to cross check you in the shoulders and that's going to hurt. But like, no, he's not going to drown you. So I don't know. There's something about Kai Lenny and that waterman athlete. I use Kai as the example, but there's a whole bunch. Oh,
I love that answer, by the way.
Just the waterman.
I love that answer because it's not obvious. And it's not because I don't love it just because it's not obvious, but I think it's your explanation of the why. I'm nodding my head there and thinking the other Kai Hurst, who's been on my podcast.
Right. He's awesome.
Who has a lung capacity of 11 liters, biggest ever tested. 11 liters. The average man, by the way, is 6 liters, just so people
that's
have
right,
a comprehension. So we're looking at almost double. And the guy, you know, went to the Olympics, open water swimming, Australia's greatest ever surf Ironman. Well, there's a couple, Trevor Hendy there with him, but absolutely insane in the surf Ironman. Raced several years in the America's Cup, you know, as a grinder, just because of his ability to never tire, but has all the power in the world. And another great waterman, exactly like you're describing Kai Lenny. I put these guys, and then, you know, you have obviously the Laird Hamiltons of the world thrown into that same kind of basket of just absolutely incredible athletes and these big wave surfers. Man, that wave at Nazareth is insane. My brain can't comprehend it. You know when you watch something and your brain's kind of going, hang on, that's the surfer? And it's like,
yeah.
It's this tiny speck. And you're like, you go to wipe your computer screen because it's like, is that it? What?
That's right. You go, you're thinking like, wait a minute, I've seen CGI. Like, is that CGI? Come on, guys. Like, you're goofing around now, right? Like, yeah. The helicopter's not that small compared to the wave.
No.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think that's there would be my answers. Like, the greatest athletes at the end of the day in my little head are the watermen. Because I just, like, I don't know. That's something I love about paddling is just the immense force of it all.
Yeah. You're up against nature. You're not up against an individual. You're up against nature. And it's like, nature
those
always wins.
But, you know, there's those two things. It's like head to the ocean, head to the hills. And so those mountaineers who, I don't know, Sir Edmund Hillary or Tenzing Norgay, the Sherpa, like those like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Did that person just climb to the top of the world with no oxygen and a, you know, that 40 pound pack that I've been carrying on my backyard thinking I'm strong, and they just carried up the world's biggest peak. Like that is like the athlete and then the waterman. And it's just, for me, it all comes back to like the basics of like, hey, look, like at the end of the day, we're just these beings that are either trying to like dive to the bottom of the ocean or climb to the top of the peak. And that's just, you know, we're bored apes, and those are the most impressive athletes.
Oh, what a great answer, mate. That's fantastic. You know, here we are throwing around all the, you know, all the Michaels, Michael Phelps, Michael Jordan, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, that whole group. Then you got the soccer players, Pele, Ronaldo, Messi. I'm missing some, I'm sure, Maradona. I actually threw in there people like Alisson Felix, who I just think is one of the most beautiful runners I think ever. Four Olympics, gold medals in all of them. Insane.
Serena Williams, all the trophies.
Yeah, well, Serena. But you know, awesome. Everybody forgets Margaret Court from Australia, who actually has one more Grand Slam than Serena. Not to take it away from Serena, obviously, she's outstanding. But I am going to throw an Australian in there, Margaret Court, who has, I think she's got 24 Grand Slams to
just a few.
Serena's 23. Emil Zatopek. Emil Zatopek, I think, is one of the most underrated as well. But mate, any what books are you reading at the moment? Any actually, you can either at the moment or ones that you're like, Greg, you gotta read this one.
The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories by Ken Liu is my go-to. Like that book just travels around with me. It's a series of short stories, and it's just, I don't know, it's super. He's just so profound. There's so many moments in that book where I was like, oh, that's how that works. Like, thank you, Ken, for explaining that to me. Like just the moments of epiphany. And then, so that's a series of short stories. That's like my go-to if I just want to read a short story and reconnect with like that, the unknown. And then Sayin Liu's The Three Body Problem. It's part of a series called Remembrance of Past Earth. It's The Three Body Problem, The Dark Forest, and Death's End. And that book just profoundly changed me. Like I read The Three Body Problem. He's the preeminent science fiction writer in China. He's won the Hugo and the Nebula for science fiction. And The Three Body Problem, I won't get into it because I would love people just to read it just from the start. But it's just, it explained a lot to me. Mm-hmm. Like it answered a lot of questions I had around just what is all this, you know? And not to say that I understand it, but just that I had a glimpse.
It makes you quit. It's great to stimulate, isn't it? Sometimes you just want stimulation. Yeah.
And then the other one is Claire Cameron wrote The Last Neanderthal. And it's just a beautiful book. And for me, it was that around motherhood. Like I was like, oh, wow. There was this profound moment in it where I appreciated the mother of our children. So I just was like, oh, that's what you like. I got a little glimpse into what she went through and goes through. And it just put me in my place. Like my role is to protect the fire. You know, like my role is to stand there and protect the fire and her role and at the end of the day, motherhood. And I was just like, that book just, it's such an incredible book, The Last Neanderthal by Claire Cameron. So yeah, Three Body Problem, nice. The Last Neanderthal by Sayin Liu. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. And The Last Neanderthal by Claire Cameron. And then the series of short stories called The Paper Menagerie by Ken Liu. Those
yeah, the paper, what are you saying? The paper what?
Paper Menagerie.
Oh, Menagerie. Got it. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's awesome. I'll put those in the show notes and I'll go check them out for myself as well. I just started another new book, Anti-Fragile.
Yeah.
Heard that one?
Nassim Talbot.
Nassim Talbot, yeah. Taleb. Yeah, nice. He wrote The Black Swan, which I haven't read that yet, but it gets referenced to in this one. Man, it's got me thinking about things.
Absolutely.
You kind of go, I love how it starts with, you know, I'm trying to understand what's the opposite of fragile. And you ask somebody that.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks, well, resilient, you know, strong. It's like, well, no, they're all the neutral side of it. They're not the opposite. And so the opposite of anti-fragile is something that gets better with stress, you know, or, you know, things that, or time or energy, whatever we can think of that, that would affect a fragile thing if in a negative way affects anti-fragile in a positive way. So it's a, I don't know. I listen to it on my morning runs before I get to the ocean and I remove my earplugs and then just take in the ocean for what it is. And then I put him back in my ear and I'm like, just let it wash over me. Like I said, you know, to you earlier, cool. It's like, just let these books wash over you. But that's pretty cool. Well, mate, this has been, we've kind of covered and gone a bit everywhere, touched on the sport of triathlon for bits.
I forgot we were on a podcast. So that was all.
There we go.
Like, oh, wait a minute. People could be potentially listening to this. I thought I was just chatting with Benno.
There you go. I've sucked you in. I've sucked you in.
Yeah, good job, bro. I love it. Absolutely love it.
What's next for you anyway, buddy? I mean,
I'm engaged in a bunch of things that I really enjoy in the day to day. But one of the things I get to do now is there's a wilderness resort up in the Broughton Archipelago, which is north of Vancouver Island at the Great Bear Rainforest. And I've been hosting people up there doing tours. And I was just up there 3 weeks ago and you're out under the stars. There's like, it is the most back to like, it's not rustic by any means, but at the end of the day, you're way out the back of the, you're at the base of the Great Bear Rainforest and you go for a little wander in there and you see these massive trees and massive boulders and you go and the guide says to you like, there's definitely a bear den over there. So let's not get that way. And, oh, those are cougar tracks. And you just feel so alive and so disconnected from it all. You know, you're just back to basics. So I've been doing that. I've been organizing some trips up there that it's really speaks to me and on so many levels about the people that are up there and the environment there and the whole process of getting there, etc. So I'm doing a lot of that. And then otherwise, it's a lot of running kids around from soccer games to dance classes to volleyball, etc. And I love that. It's awesome. We've got a whole gang of kids that are just off doing cool things. And yeah, that's life.
That's awesome, buddy.
Yeah, out of the corner of my eye, I watch triathlon.
We got to get ourselves up there to Vic. Well, once the world starts hopefully settling down a little bit, we'll come up there for a bit. Laura and I were talking about that. We got to get back to Vic. It's been, too long. So especially get out of the Florida summer.
Doug.
Yeah. Get out of the Florida summer, get up to Vic. I think it'd be perfect.
Oh, please do.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, I got some big shows, big trees to show you.
Yeah, big trees to show me. Awesome.
Yeah, that's it, man. That's the way to do it.
I love it.
We'll go to the old growth. We'll head to the old growth and stare at the trees.
Well, mate, this has been absolutely fantastic. You know, and for everybody that, you know, if you want to check out the show notes, check out those books, the timestamps, all the links and everything else will be at bennettendurance.com/media. Simon, that was fantastic, mate. Thanks.
Thanks, bro. Talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot for listening. If you enjoyed the show, your support would truly be appreciated. You can visit the Patreon page or you can subscribe with your podcast app of choice. Don't miss the next episode, so subscribe and be notified. For show notes, if you want to know more, please visit bennettendurance.com. I'm Phil Liggett, and on behalf of Greg Bennett, here's to the next time, and I hope you will join Greg again very soon.